Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our third look at the life and crimes of Joseph Paul Franklin. Before we get going, as always, the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast, Deathcast Official, or Deathcast Podcast. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a few ways you can do that. You can go to your favorite podcast app, follow the show, and leave a 5-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, just like my friends Channel and Anthony did many, many months ago, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows, but also to exclusive content such as the series I did covering Columbine, the Atlanta child murders, and the Vince McMahon series. Again, that's tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, and I do have to give a shout out to the largest Patreon contributors monthly, Debbie and Samantha. Thank you both so much for your support. Alright, now that all that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes, let's go into the crypt. Last week we left off, Joseph Paul Franklin had been arrested and had escaped from custody, fleeing down to Atlanta after stopping off in various states. Now there is a national manhunt for this man who they know, but the police really don't know that much about. Up until this point, Franklin had been very good at keeping a low profile and staying off of the police's radar. The police are going to turn to the FBI for help in tracking Joseph Paul Franklin. The FBI is actually going to issue a federal warrant for unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. The same thing that was done to Rodney Alcala. While the police are trying to track down Franklin, they start looking into his movements, places that they believe he has been over the course of the last few years based on murders that they suspect him of having perpetrated. And they very quickly discover that not only did Franklin's movements coincide with a number of murders, they also coincided with a series of bank robberies, and upon looking into these bank robberies and speaking with tellers showing mugshot photographs of Franklin, which only served to confirm their suspicions that not only was Franklin a murderer, he was also a bank robber, which is a federal crime. Ergo, now the FBI has more jurisdiction to get involved. And in tracking down Franklin, the FBI called in famed criminal profiler John Douglas to do a profiling of Joseph Paul Franklin. Now, we've already discussed my viewpoints on profiling numerous times on this show, so briefly just touch on it. It's hit or miss. Unfortunately, despite what television would have you believe, more often than not, they're way off the mark when it comes to profiling these individuals. Are on the mark. It's touted as a great success and proof that this scientific theory is infallible, which is not the case. They may get a few things right here and there on a profile, but if you look at the majority of the profiles they've done, which have been released publicly, a lot of them are so far removed from the actual perpetrator that it's actually kind of sad. But it is a tool that law enforcement uses in order to try and get an idea of who the person they might be looking for actually is. going into the Franklin case, Douglas had said that it was a challenge. As previously, many of the cases that they had worked on involved someone who was known to the victims and had some form of physical interaction during the commission of the crime. As we know from having looked at Franklin in the last few months of his full-time freedom, he had no interactions with any of his victims and, in fact, killed them from long range. And the purpose of this particular profile isn't just to get an idea of who Franklin was, but also to try and figure out where it is he might have traveled to. If you'll recall, Franklin was an anomaly among other serial killers who picked a particular area, would kill there, and then may move on afterwards, but there would be a series or a cluster of killings in a given area before they moved on. Franklin would strike and then vanish, only to strike again in another state, hundreds if not thousands of miles away, where he will commit another crime. Now, with all of this information, it's decided that federal charges will be brought against Franklin as opposed to state charges, as it's believed that none of the evidence any of the states have, including Utah, against Franklin is strong enough to make charges stick, whereas the federal charges are believed to be strong enough that they can hold him on these charges as they build a case once Franklin is in custody. Further bolstering the federal case is the fact that authorities come to believe that Franklin was involved in the assassination attempt on Vernon Jordan. Now, you're going to see a few things online stating that Joseph Paul Franklin was on the FBI 10 Most Wanted list. As was the case with Rodney Alcala, however, after a careful review of the FBI's own records, while they did put out a federal warrant for his arrest, Joseph Paul Franklin was never officially added to the 10 Most Wanted list. Yes, there are FBI agents who stated that he was on the list at the time that Franklin was a fugitive from justice, and while it may have been their intention to include Franklin on the 10 Most Wanted list, he was never officially placed onto it. And that's not information you're going to get really anywhere else. If you look in books and magazines and articles posted online, they all have that piece of information. The FBI's own website, however, does not list him as a 10 Most Wanted felon. Therefore, he is officially not, and all of that information is wrong, which is why it's important when you're doing research to actually look into facts as opposed to taking every single thing that you come across at face value. John Douglas ends up completing his profile of Franklin somewhere around October 16th, and in it he puts that he believes that Franklin will brag about his crimes at some point, return to his hometown of Mobile, Alabama, because he feels comfortable there, and more likely than not stay in the Gulf Coast region. Well, a lot of what was inside of this profile turned out to be incorrect in regards to Joseph Paul Franklin. There were some points he was correct on, specifically the fact that he would stay in the Gulf Coast region, as well as the fact that Franklin would eventually brag about the crimes that he did commit. And it's right around this point that the FBI gets another stone in the portrait that they are painting of Joseph Paul Franklin, when it is given access to a threatening letter that Franklin had written to President Jimmy Carter. Obviously, federal authorities take this threat seriously. So, as Carter is on the campaign trail in the fall of 1980, at every stop that Carter makes, agents and Secret Service men pass out pictures of Joseph Paul Franklin. Now, it's during all of this deep dive into Joseph Paul Franklin's background, that they learned that his birth name was not, in fact, Joseph Paul Franklin. It was James Clayton Vaughn. And that Vaughn, or Franklin, had a history of arrests as well as numerous warrants out for his arrest in the South. They really didn't know a whole lot about Franklin at this point, who he was, what made him tick. And as the manhunt is going on, we're going to step away for a period of time and we're going to examine just exactly who Joseph Paul Franklin was. What things had he gone through in his life that turned him into a racist assassin that terrorized the country for over 3 years with no one really knowing that he was operating? Joseph Paul Franklin was born James Clayton Vaughn Jr. on April 13th, 1950. To alcoholic parents, James Clayton Vaughn Sr. and Helen. Now, James's mother was 9 years older than her husband, and there were other children in this relationship, two half-sisters and a half-brother from his mother's previous marriage, as well as an older sister, Carolyn, and then two younger siblings, Marilyn and Gordon. It's been said that James's mother was raised in a very strict German household in Mobile, Alabama, along with seven other siblings, describing Helen, a friend who lived with her for a period of time during her first marriage, said, quote, "A full-blooded German, a real strict perfectionist lady. I never saw her beat any of them, but they told me stories." James's father, James Sr., was a disabled Navy veteran who worked as a butcher by trade. By all accounts, he was a hard, vicious man who was prone to epileptic seizures, which, coupled with his raging alcoholism, led James Sr. to lose his job not long after Franklin was born. Franklin and his siblings had a very hard upbringing, marred by serious violence perpetrated on them by their parents. The family moved fairly often, and the stories of the beatings that the children received, particularly Franklin, are fairly horrific, as is the neglect that the children received. Franklin's older sister, Carolyn, recounted to a researcher that when she was 6 and Franklin was 3, the family had been living in Dayton, Ohio, and her mother had given their father money to get Caroline a pair of shoes. Instead, the senior, James, had gone on a drinking binge, returning after a week and beating their mother to the point that she lost the child she was pregnant with at that point. Not long after this, the family moved to New Orleans, before eventually settling back into Mobile, Alabama. Now, in order to fully understand Joseph Paul Franklin, we have to look into his surroundings. The South that Joseph Paul Franklin grew up in was one of segregation and violence against blacks, but is also one in which the black community was starting to try and throw off the yoke of decades of violence, oppression, and mistreatment by those they called neighbors. As Franklin is getting older and the civil rights movement really starts to take shape, he's hearing things from those adults whom he looks up to that begin to shape his worldview as well as his perspective on individuals who look differently from him. Franklin's close relatives, as well as his extended relatives, had very strong racist ideologies, particularly on his father's side. Franklin's father had family comes from the Mobile area, and he was inundated with this from a very young age. This idea that they were getting, quote, uppity, that they didn't deserve to be integrated into white society. So naturally, Franklin is going to start taking these ideas on to himself. That doesn't make it right. That is the reality of it. Especially during his most formative years, Franklin was heavily influenced by the things that he saw and heard from those adults that were around him, as well as heard echoed by the kids that he went to school with. So at some point, Franklin begins to get a resentment against those that he has been taught are inferior to him. And as he's growing up, he takes on more of the mindset of these adults. And we see this a lot in children that are abused. In an effort to try and please their abusers, they will mimic and take on their mindset in, you know, a fleeting hope that by doing so, by being able to maybe please this individual, they will stop hurting them. I think with Franklin, though, that it's more than that. Not only did he see his parents engaging in this type of behavior, he almost certainly had classmates whose parents or fathers and grandfathers and uncles were involved in organizations such as the Ku Klux Klan. But he also had the government of Alabama really reaffirming the beliefs of the adults that he looked up to. And the stories of blacks being targeted by not only law enforcement officials, but also by institutions within the state of Alabama and other southern states, including, you know, the governor and mayors of towns, reads almost like a list of what didn't they do to these people. And while I'm no psychologist, I can say with some degree of certainty that seeing and hearing this type of thing, that the powers that be were condoning this sort of activity and were even participating in themselves, I'm sure did quite a bit to bolster Franklin's worldview and make it seem not only the correct thing to do and the correct mindset to have, but right and his right to do as a white American who was, as many of these types of individuals believe, protecting not only his family, but also, you know, the rights of all other white men and the way of life that they had known for generations. Now, Franklin was not an unintelligent individual. All records indicate that he was, in fact, extremely bright. Although, as he grew older and the abuse and neglect at home got worse, his grades began to slip heavily. We know that somewhere around the age of 8, Franklin's parents separated, and that on the rare occasions his father would come back to the family, it would be nothing short of a bloodbath, as James Sr. would show up, beat everyone, stay for a period of time, during which these beatings continued and grew worse before leaving again. So he has all of this, all of these negative influences and these negative reinforcers in his life. But there is also evidence that Franklin suffered various head traumas throughout his adolescent years. According to his older sister Caroline, their father had a cane that he used to hit the children with, particularly Joseph, who had scars on his scalp from the beatings his father would give. She recounted a story where her brother had gone outside to eat a bag of popcorn. His father followed him out of the house, knocked him to the ground, kicked the bag of popcorn away, and simply started beating him without reason. And Franklin's parents didn't save the abuse for only their own children. They also were known to beat neighborhood children, particularly his mother, who was known to babysit other children in the neighborhood after her divorce from James Sr., and would dish out the same forms of brutalized punishment to the children put into her care as she did her own. His sister Caroline further went on to state that their mother was almost certainly a psychopath. She would often abuse animals that the children brought home or strays that came into their yard, and it wasn't long before her brothers began to do similar things, abusing cats and dogs, sometimes killing them. But she did state that, unlike the others, James began to rebel against his parents and would begin to hit back as he got older, and his temperament grew worse. Both of his sisters recounted stories of James and his brother fighting in the house, but also of them shooting guns off inside of their bedroom, as one wall was a brick wall. The youngest daughter, Marilyn, recounted, would line books up against the wall. The wall was concrete. This was living in the projects. And they would shoot guns, and there were bullet holes in all over the walls. And if I came in and I was nice and they were in a good mood, they'd let me shoot too. Reflecting back on James, both sisters stated that he was quote-unquote strange and angry. Instances of his strangeness include the fact that Franklin began to exhibit food phobias and germophobia, going so far as to refuse to drink from glasses or eat from plates that anyone else in the house had used, even if they had been washed. In describing himself, Franklin stated he had always thought he was weird, with a capital W. A very significant part of Franklin's quote-unquote weirdness stemmed from the fantasy life that he had built up inside of his own mind. Many serial killers begin early on in life by having very strong fantasy lives, often characterized by acts of power or violence against others. Franklin, by his own accounts, lost himself in fairy tales, which he picked up from reading books. All siblings who've been spoken to all agreed on one thing, and that is the fact that James Franklin was a voracious reader. Out of all the siblings, he too seemed to possess an innate ability at drawing, an ear for music, and an intelligence that was well beyond his years. In describing her younger brother, Carolyn likes to point out a story concerning James when he was 7 years old riding his bicycle. While the story has never really been Expounded upon, we know that Franklin lost the eyesight in his right eye completely and was nearly blind in his left eye. Obviously, some form of serious head trauma occurred, which, coupled with the beatings his father would routinely give him, I have no doubt further caused damage to his psyche as well as to his mental capacity. Now, I'm not saying that Joseph Paul Franklin was insane or anything of the sort, only that a lot of evidence exists that points to a correlation between head trauma and serial violence. You couple all of that together with the trauma of his growing up, and, you know, begs the question, was Joseph Paul Franklin a case of nature versus nurture? Now, unfortunately, because there's no way to do a control group with this type of thing, we are left to speculate as to whether or not an individual like Joseph Paul Franklin would have become what he did become had he grown up in a normal, loving household without any form of abuse or head trauma, or if he was simply born that way and the various horrific things that happened to him as he was growing up only served as further fuel for that separatist mentality that he possessed. In looking at his teenage years, we see a young man who is lost in his own world, searching for an identity of his own, while seeking a way out of the circumstances that life has thrust upon him. It's been said that Franklin was an extremely spiritually driven individual, joining fringe religions such as the Moonies, while also attending various Christian churches in and around Mobile. And somewhere during all of this, he came across something known as British Israelism, which would eventually morph into the Christian Identity Movement. For those who followed this show for any period of time, you've heard me mention the Christian Identity Movement. For those who are new to the Deathcast, I'll cover it briefly. It is a racist mindset, white supremacist specifically, that states that Jesus and everything in the Bible was written for white men. They are the chosen people of God, and every other race is to be submissive to them because they are inferior to them. I'm not going to go off on a political rant because I have no political ideology, as I think it is a tool for the mindless. But if you look at our country today, you can see a lot of this type of mentality of everything was created for the white man and we must protect that at all costs, including but not limited to the removal of human life from those who threaten it, as well as the taking away of their rights. And knowing now what we do about Franklin's background, his years growing up, it is easy to see why he would be drawn towards such a movement that, you know, by really fucked up means, gives empowerment to individuals who feel powerless over their own lives and the things that are going on around them. And one of the key components to all of this for James was his interpretation of the Bible, which basically gave credence to everything that he believed in. Those who knew Franklin stated over and over again that he could quote to you from the Bible chapter and verse, and in doing so, get across his views on race. Franklin didn't just look to a skewed religious ideology to help him perfect his views on race, however. We know that he became fascinated with Adolf Hitler towards the end of the late 1960s, going so far as to steal Mein Kampf from the Mobile Public Library. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hey there, my D&Ders. This is your old buddy Ian here with a brand new sponsor this week. Now, you've all heard me talk about Chinese teachers in the past. I have never promoted a Chinese teacher quite like Chinese teacher Evian. Evian is a sweet, honest, and dedicated teacher who teaches every day. She not only makes certain that her students understand the differences in tonal pronunciation, she allows them the opportunity to get up during the class and read what it is that she is teaching so that each student knows that they are getting the best possible education and is pronouncing the words and tones correctly. So I'd like you to do right now is go to tinyurl.com/EvianCT and check her out. That's tinyurl.com/EvianCT. She makes learning this beautiful and wonderful language a lot of fun. And remember, Mandarin Chinese is the fastest growing language in the international job market today. This is the language that you want to learn if you don't want to work that boring 9-to-5 job, but you want to get a foothold in a company that has an international presence. They're all looking for Mandarin speakers, so let Evian be the one to introduce you to this language. You won't be disappointed.
Hey there, D&Ders, your friend Ian here with another brand new sponsor this week. Artwork by Katie. Now, as the son of a fairly successful artist, I grew up around the art world, saw many different styles of art. I know good art from bad, and I can honestly say that in addition to being a good friend, Katie is one of the best artists I have ever had the pleasure of seeing. Her works of art, be it drawings or paintings, are absolutely amazing. And Katie doesn't just do original works of art, she also does commission pieces. So if you're looking for that perfect piece of art to offset the decor in your home, office, or even in your place of business, go check out Artwork by Katie at linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. That's linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. You'll be blown away. According to Franklin, he joined the National Socialist White People's Party, the American Nazi Party, when he was 13 years old, saying, quote, "I became really obsessed with the Nazi Party." Whether or not you believe the age that Franklin stated he joined the Nazi Party at or not, we do know that eventually he is a card-carrying member of the American Nazi Party, as well as a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And that, at least according to Franklin, Mein Kampf was the most important book in his life and the one that set him on his road to serial murder, as he believed he was ordained by God to start a race war in the United States. By the mid to late 1960s, Franklin was espousing his various beliefs to anyone who would listen. This included the woman who would end up being his first wife. After dropping out of high school in junior year, it's said that Franklin's mood became more and more unstable, to the point that he would engage in violent confrontations with his mother that led to police involvement. By February of 1968, he had met a 16-year-old by the name of Bobby Louise Dorman, who Franklin took as his first wife. Now, Bobby stated that at first the marriage was fine, but after a few weeks together, he suddenly changed like somebody had thrown a light switch, and he became violent and cruel towards her. She described Franklin beating her so violently on numerous occasions that she feared he was going to murder her, but also described periods where Franklin would cry hysterically, complaining of headaches, which he refused to elaborate on or to give any details about. Bobby gives some idea as to Franklin's mindset. She stated that on many occasions she would find her husband hiding in a corner, crying to himself and muttering about his father. Yet in the same sentence, she will also tell how James had fantasies in his head of joining an outlaw motorcycle gang, describing his manner of dress as similar to that of a 1960s biker, replete with various Nazi insignia and cowboy boots. And she also contradicts Franklin's statements that he joined the Nazi party at age 13 by stating, quote, "He used to fantasize that he was a Hell's Angel. You know, he had the jeans and the jacket and he carried a knife, but he never owned a bike. It was like James just wanted something to belong to, something different. I guess the Nazis were about as different as you could get." The couple end up having a child, and while James promises to do better and apologizes to his wife for the beatings that he gives her, invariably he will return to this behavior over and over again, something that is very common against serial abusers. His wife stated that when the housing project that they lived in became integrated, not long after the two of them had become married, she noticed a very stark shift in Franklin's personality. Again, contradicting stories he would later state, his wife Bobby said that it was during this point in time that a friend of Franklin's began giving him Klan literature and Nazi literature to read. To quote Franklin, quote, "Once you consciously go over the stuff again and again, it just goes down in your conscience and you begin to think that blacks and Jews aren't even people at all." That really seems to be the crux of Franklin, looking for a place to belong, a place where he fits in and where he can be special and revered. We know that at some point he and his wife separated and eventually divorced. We also know that at some point, he ended up moving from Mobile to Washington, D.C., so that he could take up active membership in the American Nazi Party. And it's at this point that pretty much everyone from his old life loses track of Franklin. We know from his sister Caroline that he came back at some point in the early 1970s, somewhere around 72, 73, only to discover that his mother had died. This seems to have upset him a great deal, although Franklin ends up getting into a fight with his older sister when he discovers that she has a black maid. This serves as enough of a reason for Franklin to sever all contact with his sister, and the two of them would never see one another again. Concerning his involvement with the Nazi Party, Franklin himself contradicts his earlier statements by stating, quote, "I was just 18 when I first got into the movement, you know, just started reading Mein Kampf and getting into Nazi philosophy, and as time went on, I just became more into it. I took it seriously, whereas a lot of other people were just talking about it." Franklin later said in interviews that it was around this point in time the early 1970s that he really started to have overtly violent fantasies. He had always had fantasies that involved some form of violence while he was growing up. Now, however, they are starting to take shape, and as often happens with many serial murderers, they begin to focus specifically on a target. In Franklin's case, Jews and African Americans. Obviously, this was bolstered by his involvement with the American Nazi Party. We're going to look at this section of his life a little more in depth, just briefly. The Nazi Party had been founded by a man named George Lincoln Rockwell in 1959 in Arlington, Virginia. Rockwell was a businessman, the son of a vaudeville performer, who was assassinated on August 25th, 1967 by a man called John Tatler, an ex-member of the Nazi Party. From this assassination, the Nazi Party splintered into many different groups, one section becoming a proponent of the Christian identity movement, while a former member by the name of William Luther Pierce would go on to found the National Alliance, a group of scumbags. While the party itself pushed forward renaming itself to the National Socialist White People's Party, formerly apparently had been called the American Nazi Party, which is what James officially joined. Now, Franklin later said that he felt as though he never had a family. He was disenfranchised with life and knew that these people shared the same beliefs that he did. And upon arriving in the Washington, D.C. area, he felt like he was among family for the first time in a long time. That is part of the tactic that groups like this, supremacist groups, and let's get this out of the way right now, there's not just white supremacist groups. Any group that proclaims one race over the other to be superior is a supremacist group and is therefore dog shit, such as the Black Panthers or the New Black Panthers. They're all the fucking same. I don't care. They all propagate race propaganda and violence and separation. Anyways, Franklin is inundated with this type of mentality as he's living in the area. According to informants, in 1969, he was tasked with organizing an attack against the New Mobilization Committee to end the war in Vietnam. These individuals stated that Franklin was not well-liked in the members of the Nazi Party because he refused to adhere to any of the precepts set down from above. He was not clean-shaven. He didn't wear the uniform. He looked more like a hippie than he did a Nazi, etc. Eventually, the leadership of the party is able to convince members to help Franklin carry out this attack, which basically consisted of Franklin storming their headquarters, setting off tear gas canisters, and fleeing. The canisters forced an evacuation of the building. Some have stated that the Manson murders, which took place not long after that, served as part of the inspiration for Franklin. However, Franklin wanted to go after what he saw as the problem, i.e. blacks and Jews, as opposed to wealthy white elitists. In his mind, the single greatest threat to whitedom was race mixing. The following year, Franklin attends a protest outside the White House where he's actually wearing a Nazi uniform. This protest was against the then Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir visiting. Now, during the next few years, Franklin continues his association with the Nazi Party, working odd jobs and being arrested on occasion for carrying concealed weapons. It would later come to light, too, that he had a propensity for verbally attacking racially mixed couples anywhere that he encountered them. Speaking on this period of his life many years later, Franklin stated that he really began to formulate the idea of carrying out murders of interracial couples. As with most serial killers, though, James has yet, by this point, the early 1970s, found that outside stressor that will push him from the realm of fantasy into the realm of action. We know that he was arrested on October 25th, 1972 in Fairfax County, Virginia, for carrying a weapon, and that 2 days after this, his mother passed away. A fact which I stated earlier he did not learn about until returning to Mobile in 1973. After this, Franklin goes back to Washington, D.C., where he gets a job working as a maintenance worker before moving to Atlanta in 1974, where he earns his GED. In Atlanta, Franklin joins a group called the National States Rights Party, which was led by a notorious racist by the name of J.B. Stoner. He also comes into the sphere of James Earl Ray and his brother Jerry. Now, while some contend that Franklin was not an individual who followed others, I want to counter that with this thought. You look at any of these ridiculous hate groups, there's always a leader calling for violence against one group or another, yet they never carry it out themselves. Instead, they leave it to a usually undereducated, meanly employed member to go and carry out these acts as they attempt to insulate themselves from the things that their underlings do by saying they were, you know, speaking in a theoretical manner or did not call for violence against others. This group in Atlanta that Franklin had gotten himself involved with, led by J.B. Stoner, was known particularly for Stoner's verbal tirades calling for the mass extermination of Jews. This group had a history of violence against individuals within the civil rights movement, not only with ties to the murder of Martin Luther King, but other acts of terror, including firebombing churches and dynamiting synagogues. We know that Franklin was there for some period of time enrolling in a community college, although none of this would last long, as his sister Marilyn later stated, Franklin ends up moving back to the Maryland area and ends up earning a blue belt in karate while living in an abandoned office building that he was hired to maintain. She stated that she eventually moved in with her brother for a period of time and, quote, if he ever saw white and black together, he'd go right up and say that's disgusting or something like that. Lots of people don't like the colored, but he was one to let you know it. She also stated that any time she happened to glance at a black individual, whether they were male or female, Franklin would become enraged. We can also see an underlying mental disorder with Franklin in other activities that he undertook. His sister stated that He was very germ conscious and would not allow her to touch any door handles anywhere if they went somewhere, as he believed that a black may have touched it. Instead, Franklin would use disposable napkins to open doors and would make them leave if they entered a building and blacks were present. In addition to all of this, he also controlled the things that his sister listened to, demanding that she not listen to any music that was in any way associated with either a black musician or producer or a Jewish musician or producer. Marilyn ends up moving out after James discovers letters his sister had been receiving from a Mexican boyfriend that was living in Montgomery, Alabama. And the two of them will not see each other again until 1978. We know that Franklin would go out during this period of time and seek confrontations with mixed-race couples, spraying them in the face with mace, chasing them in whichever vehicle that he happened to be driving. I've read some accounts of him shooting out tires on cars or busting out windows on vehicles that were driven by a mixed-race couple. We also know that he began sending letters to various members of the U.S. government, threatening them, including Jimmy Carter. And eventually, Franklin's going to end up back down in Atlanta, where he's going to join the KKK, specifically a group known as the United Klans of America. So active was Franklin during this period of time in the Klan, he ends up being made a Kliegel, whatever the fuck that is. We know that Franklin moved around a lot during this period of time, going to various Klan and Nazi Party training camps where he learned weapons usage. He also joined the Alabama National Guard's 161st Medical Battalion at some point in roughly spring of 1977, although Franklin could not remember the date. He did state that the only thing he got from his short stint in the National Guard was further experience with weaponry. Somewhere in all of this, Franklin ends up leaving the Klan as he felt that they were quote-unquote a joke. And it's at this point, according to Franklin again, he began teaching himself sniper skills. We know that on September 21st, 1976, he followed an interracial couple to a dead-end street and then sprayed the two of them with mace. He ends up being arrested for this incident and released on bail, at which point Franklin officially goes on the lam. Franklin later stated that he felt this point in his life was the turning point, the point of no return where he had crossed a bridge from which there was no coming back. He felt in his heart that both the Nazi Party and the KKK were too soft and unwilling to take any action of their own, and as he believed that he had been ordained by God as his chosen weapon to ignite a race war, it was his responsibility to go out and commit acts of violence against interracial couples. Some have pointed to this arrest and jumping bail as the stressor, that outside force that pushed Franklin into his life of crime and murder. As prior to this, he had only ever thought about committing acts of violence against blacks. But with this particular act and the subsequent police involvement, and then their inability to stop him after he jumps bail, Franklin begins to feel free for the first time in his life, but also to start to feel that he is in fact invincible. On September 21st, 1976, James Clayton Vaughn Jr. signs a petition to legally change his name to Joseph Paul Franklin. Joseph Paul after Paul Joseph Goebbels, and Franklin after Benjamin Franklin. He told people that he knew that he changed his name because he discovered who his real father was and wanted to adopt his father's name, while his sister Caroline would later state that she believed the reason he changed his name was because he hated their father so much and did not want anything in his life to remind him of the man who had treated he and his siblings so horribly growing up. I personally believe that he changed his name at this point as Franklin is going through this stressor in his life that is leading him towards becoming a serial killer, and in order for him to fully embrace this, he has to shed every vestige of his former life and be born anew as someone completely different. And in doing so, in changing this name, in his mind at least, he's able to leave the pain and humiliation of the past behind and take up this mission that he has set before himself, which is what Franklin is. He's a mission-oriented serial killer. And from this point on, Franklin is going to grow increasingly more brazen in his attitudes and his actions, but also more antisocial to those around him. This is that point in time, really, where Franklin is going to toss off the vestiges of living a normal life, for the most part, and embark on this nomadic, violent lifestyle, which would see many people dead, and Franklin eventually imprisoned and sentenced to death. We're going to end the episode at this point. I hope that you guys have enjoyed this look into Joseph Paul Franklin, and we will be back next week with the next part in this series. Again, if you enjoy the show, don't forget to follow me on social media, and go check out the Patreon, tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon. $1.99 a month gets you access to over 100 episodes, both early bird editions as well as exclusive episodes. That's tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon. Until next time, stay morbid!